Howdy. My name, let me make sure my pants are zipped. Yes. Patch is straight. My name is Chris Raymer. I'm very grateful recovered alcoholic. Those are great little shirts. Did y'all see the little Soberilla guy, the little pirate guy with a little black eye patch? Yeah. This is not a prop, okay? So don't come up and say, can I wear your patch? Don't do it. It just freaks me out. I'm in a room where pirate jokes are going to live forever. Don't start it. You'll be on my shit list forever. I'm just telling you. I work at a place down on Padre Island, and I did not think of that before I took that job. I mean, I'm in pirate heaven down there on the island, and oh my gosh! I mean, I ride a bicycle back and forth to work, and how much hassle do you think I take? You know, that's the way it is. I am so grateful to be here. I've had a chance with Larry a few times to share the podium, and we're buds from hell, and we're honored to be here. We're going to spend the first hour kind of sorting this out a little bit, and then we're going to get into the steps here in that second hour. And I want to visit with y'all. I got to thank Dan for picking me up. I had to come in a day early because Texas actually iced over. They closed airports in Texas, San Antonio and Austin, Houston. So I raced to the airport yesterday afternoon so I could catch a flight, and we made all the connects, and I'm here. So I'm delighted to be here. Where else but AA can you get an applause just for showing up? That's pretty cool. Some of you guys, I've been in Florida a few times, and it's so great to see some of my buds and Eric's in here, and a bunch of you guys came from long distance to be here, and I'm honored to be here. I'd love to stay in touch with all of you. We're going to have plenty of breaks, and we have a chance to visit one-on-one. And I also brought my little rubber stamp. I know Larry did too. If you want to get your little book stamped in the front with the circle triangle stuff, we do a lot of that. And it would just be a delight to spend some time with you. I want to tell you a little bit about me real quick. And I'm going to give you my usual little disclaimer. I would rather do these workshops than anything. I have a real problem sometimes with these little talks I get to do on Saturday night, you know, and you come in and you do a talk and, you know, you get just enough to, you know, fall in love with some people and get them to hate you, and then you leave, and it's just everybody starts. And here it's like it's a really cool thing. I'm going to be the first to tell you that I am perfectly capable on any given day to be a fool on the podium. I get to do this a lot and have for a long time. I've spoke from podiums for 20 years in our fellowship. But I'm here to share my experience with you. And my experience is going to be different than your experience. And I try to share this from every podium that I talk about. Guys, we all got here in little different ways. And some of you guys walked in the back door of an AA meeting, and some of you guys came through treatment, and some of you obviously came through the judicial system. Because you just look like a convict. I don't know what to tell you, but some of you are drop dead gorgeous, and some of you are it's okay, guys. It's okay. Some of you are duly diagnosed, and I know we got some little dope fiends from hell in here, because you're always sneaking in these rooms, and that's all. And I love you, and a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about is going to be applicable. But I'm here. I'm going to share my experience with you. I was one of these things. Some of y'all grind on the expression. I was a chronic relapser. I was one of these guys that wanted to stay sober and needed to stay sober and could not stay sober. And I spent a whole bunch of years trying to get well. I spent 7 years sitting in AA picking up desire chips. Not once in 7 years did I ever pick up a 30-day chip. I'm that guy. You'll follow. I'm that guy that everybody pretty much gave up on, and I'm never going to get sober. And it wasn't because I didn't want to get sober, guys. And that's hindsight for me. I look back, and I mean, could I have participated more? Absolutely. Could I have gone to some better meetings? Got a spot? Absolutely. The problem is we're going to discuss this weekend, is that there's a lot of people that believe that the newcomer, for some strange reason, should know the questions to ask. And the little new guy comes in the door and says, I want to get sober. Well, welcome. And you sit down, and you may or may not, depending on the group you land in, hear the solution to alcoholism. I'm not trying to be controversial. I'm just saying. God's in every meeting of AA tonight. And there's nobody out there that loves AA more than me. But we're making some mistakes in our fellowship. As a parent to the low success rates that we see and the problem that some people have getting sober. Everybody just always wants to scrape it back onto the newcomer. Well, he just didn't want it. Anybody in here that relapses, there'll be somebody in your home group. Well, she just didn't want it. Of course she wanted it. But see, guys, the people that want to get sober or need to get sober are not the people that are going to get sober. There's certain things that you got to do in order for this miracle to take place. It doesn't happen, contrary to popular belief, by osmosis. We don't just come sit in a meeting and get well. Some of you can, and then we're going to talk about that next hour. But here's my deal. I nearly died getting to AA, guys. And when I finally got sober, I had some people that showed me the solution. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And I got to tell you, I was about 5 years sober, and somebody offered me a job doing clerical work in a treatment center. And I've been an administrator. I've done clerical work in treatment centers for 20 years. And I'm not here to talk about that. Thank God. But what I get to see on a daily basis is people coming into these hospitals and that look on their face when they realize that we're talking 12 step. We're talking about recovery as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We do thousands of other things with them. Of course we do. But when they see the steps and the traditions on the wall, they go, oh, no. You think for this amount of money we would do something. I mean, no. And I said, buddy, what's up? What's wrong? I've seen it 1,000 times. I tell the story all the time. You get them in there about the time the Ativan starts wearing off and they got a little Pop-Tart hanging out of their mouth. You know, they're detoxing like hell, you know, and they're looking around and they go, oh man, I've tried AA. It doesn't work. And it breaks my heart because it does work. The problem is what you consider I tried AA means I went to a whole bunch of meetings. That's not AA. Come on, guys. Some of you, your hair lights on fire when I say that. I'm not knocking meetings, but if you can stay sober just going to a meeting, then you're not the alcoholic of my variety. You're not the alcoholic that Bill Wilson talks about. He's the one that talks about the real alcoholic. Boy, say that, have that as a topic in one of your AA meetings and see, watch and see him. It looked like The Exorcist and there are people leaving. It's like, oh my God. What do you mean real alcoholic? You think you're special? Yeah. And we're going to get into it on the first step stuff. But my heart goes out to the cat that really wants to get sober and can't get sober. Man, I'm going to gravitate to that cat. I mean, if you can go to a meeting and stay sober, man, I'm not saying you're not welcome. You are. I have a nice life. You're just not like me. And I want to be there for the cat that really wants to get well. You want to come in and out. You want to do it your way. Everything's fine. You know, there's an old guy one time said, you know, in Texas, we call this the expression, there's more than one way to skin a cat. They say that in Atlanta? Yeah. Y'all know that expression? Sure. There's more than one way to tell your best friend that his sister's ugly. Y'all know that expression? It's the same thing. Guys, there's lots of ways that we can come at this. And I don't care. Whatever works for you, go. Thumbs up. Let's have a good time. Rock on. I didn't come over here to educate you. My deal is that there's a lot of people that I come across that are sitting in AA that can't get sober, and I want to help them. There's a lot of people that I come across that are sitting in AA that are sober and miserable. And those are my peeps. Those are the cats that we gravitate to. And that's all where this, you give me the end stage alcoholic that's given up hope, and I can do the same thing them old boys did for me in 1987. And that's what I did. My goal is to always continue to try to be a better sponsor. Ultimately, guys, that's what this weekend's about. You know, some of you all won't be here tomorrow, and we'll get some new fresh batch in, and they won't hear this little disclaimer coming in the door. But ultimately, I think that's what all of us want to do, is be a better representative of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to sponsor more men, not less. I want to do it more effectively. I want more of my guys to stay sober than they are today. And that's what I get to learn. I get to learn from you guys, and hopefully y'all can take some of the stuff that we're talking about here and be better out there, be more effective. We got a bunch of cats out there, guys, wearing out. We got people in there we're going to talk about tomorrow afternoon about sponsorship. We got guys that are just flat wore out because they're sponsoring everybody in the group, especially with the women. And we need more women. We need more women out there sponsoring. We need more guys out there. And that's why we need to encourage the newcomers to get active in this. One of my biggest pet peeves in Alcoholics Anonymous today is that we've got a whole bunch of people telling newcomers what they can't do because somebody told that to them. And I want to discuss that a little bit now and get it off the table so we can just move on down the road. I don't think we got enough people in the trench to tell anybody they can't do anything. If the guy's breathing, he's got a little big book and he understands the steps, he's worked them himself, he can relay that message. And I'm not going to stand in the way of that process between him and a newcomer and God. I'm just not gonna, because he doesn't happen to have as much sobriety as me. Am I a better sponsor than he's going to be on any given day? Absolutely, because I'm perfect. Okay. In a little 10-minute history, in 1971, let me mention this before I get cranking in here. I'll give you my email address. If any of you guys, I got cards up here. If I run out, I'll write it on something and so you guys can have it. But any of the stuff that I talk about, I may refer to some articles. I may refer to some literature. And what I want you to do is I want you to send me a nice little email and connect the dots, and I'll send that to you. I'm not really technically too savvy, but I'm savvy enough to do that. And I figured out cut and paste the other day. So I'm going to hook you up. And so I didn't bring a bunch of handouts with you because a lot of you guys, you take them and you just, I don't know. It's just the ones that really want them don't get them. And then I spend all the time trying to play catch up. Just send me the email and I'll forward you anything we're talking about. There's several books out there I would love. Any of you guys that are interested in the history, I'm not talking about AA history. I'm talking about history of recovery in this country. There's some great books out there about treatment and about the recovery arc out there. The little piece of history that I talk about from the podium a lot of times is about 1971, there was a piece of legislation called the Hughes Act that got passed in the United States. Senator Hughes out of Iowa, and Marty Mann and Bill Wilson, right before he passed away, there was everybody pushing to try to get this piece of legislation in the United States. Basically, what we were trying to do, we have been for a generation, is to get parity with other illnesses. Alcoholism is a disease. I'm so tired of listening to speakers from the podium. Alcoholism isn't a disease. It's an illness. Alcoholism, according to the American Medical Association, is a disease. Bite me. I don't know what to tell you. How do we know that? Listen, because I could take a good-looking woman here on the front row. She's an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. We come from completely different background, completely different history. But the symptoms are going to be the same. That's what labels this. The solution's the same. The symptoms are the same. We got to start separating all of this nonsense. Anyway, we've been trying to get parity because, I mean, if I'm an alcoholic and it's an illness, then the insurance company should pay for me to get help just like heart or diabetes or anything else that's a problem. So when this little piece of legislation, Pat Nixon was the guy that finally signed it in. He did it on his way out of the White House. He hated this piece of legislation. He figured it was going to cost us a fortune. It wasn't going to be worth a poo. But he signed it and threw us a finger and walked out the door. You know, he just, you're not going to kick me around anymore. But the good news is he signed it. Okay, so what happened was, like 24 hours later, they started opening treatment centers in this country, which was a really good thing for a lot of us. A lot of you in this room right now got treatment because of that piece of legislation. Bill Wilson called it the largest 12-step call ever. It was pretty cool what happened. The problem is when you get recovery and you get all this money involved in this thing, things started kind of going south. What happens was we started building treatment centers on like every corner. There used to be a problem. We couldn't get you in anywhere because there weren't any treatment centers. Makes sense. They were dry out. They were deep. They were state funded, state hospital systems and detox centers. There was a few places, but for actual treatment where you could go and be around other people that were trying to get well from the same thing, there just weren't any at that time. I mean, you think about it, 1970s, early on, there was nothing. They started opening all these treatment centers. So what started happening was that we had a whole bunch of people coming into our fellowship all at once. It took us till 1971 It took us 36 years to get 500,000 people in AA. From 1971 to 1976, we doubled in size. In the next 5 years, it was amazing to watch the growth coming into this deal. By 1990 in the United States, we had 90% of all of our hospital beds in the United States were psychiatric and alcohol beds, alcoholism and drug addiction beds. There's a great book out there called Bedlam, and I'll get you the information on it if you want to read it. It's fascinating what happened in the States. And I'm not knocking any of that. That's just great. But I'm just saying, guys, we've got an illness that affects about 15% of our population, and we got 40% of our beds trying to get them. So what happened? We got to fill those beds with something. And we did. Alcoholics and addicts got a few of them beds. And the rest were fruitcakes. Fools, malcontents. You get caught with a joint, you're coming to treatment. There's no, and listen, a lot of people benefited from that. I'm not knocking it. The problem is that a lot of those people that weren't us stayed. And we had so many people come in that the kind of sponsorship, Bill Wilson wrote a lot about it. He talks about the low success rates even as early as the 60s. And he talks about those people not getting the sponsorship that we got in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. You'd come into AA in 1935, somebody would grab you by the neck and pull you in and start explaining what the steps look like. And it wasn't going to be an option whether you were going to do this. If you were in this room, we're going to get you through the steps at a rapid pace so you could turn around and help us help other people get into the... Y'all follow? And now we've turned into a guy in my sponsorship lineage named Don P. out of Colorado. A lot of you guys knew him. He spoke. He was just a wonderful man. One of his last talks, in fact, it was his last talk. I just heard an excerpt from it the other day. It's sad if you listen to it, but he died the next day. But one of the lines in his talk, I'm going to paraphrase, he says, at a certain point in our history, we started focusing on sobriety rather than recovery. You get that? It's the whole room like this, and half of you went like this. I know. Let me be. It's not the same thing. Not drinking one stupid day at a time is not the same thing as being recovered. Can I get a witness? All right. I know it's better than not. I'm not knocking that. But understand that there's a whole big difference. In 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm trying to stay sober a day at a time. I'm trying to do all the things that you guys are asking me to do. I'm going to lots of meetings, but I can't stay sober. I'm watching my clock. I grew up in the hill country was born out in West Texas, but grew up in the hill country. My twin brother and I, Myers is doing a talk. Some of y'all know him. He's doing a talk over in Washington tonight in Washington State. And I'm on this side of we're waving from afar, you know, but we started drinking about the same time. Identical twins. That's, you know, most of us that are identical twins have our it's going to get both of us. This is a genetic predisposed illness, and that's what we're going to get. So anyway, we lit up like a neon sign. My dad was an alcoholic, and we come by it natural, big time. I got a little sister, though, that didn't. I saw my little sister and half-sister. We saw them at Christmas time. They freak us out. You know, they were drinking those little mimosas, you know, at Christmas time, and, you know, like it. And they all had one little deal, and they set it down. I said, like, man, this is just, are you going to finish that? Are you going to drink that, the rest of that? It's like, it freaks me. And she says, no, it got hot. it got hot because you're messing with it. And I don't. I've been sober 26 years. It still drives me crazy. I don't care if there's a dead cricket floating in it. I'm going to drink it. That's what I'm saying. They're not alcoholic. They don't understand where we come from. But guys, I'm not drinking because what a wonderful festive drink. I don't care. Open that can of Sterno. It's going to do the same thing. I'm going to get downtown, and that's the way it is. And so, anyway, I'm in and out. I'm in the food business, and I'm... One minute I'm pretty successful, and next minute I'm not so successful, and I'm trying to hold it together. And I'm not going to get into a whole bunch of long. I ended up in Atlanta for a period of time, and back to Houston, and back to Hill. I'm doing geographics, trying to move. I was in Austin for a long time, and it's just nuts. I'm running from me every place I go, you know, and it's like, I'll never forget that conversation with my mom. I said, Mom, I got to get out of Houston. I'm drinking too much. And she says, well, where are you going to go? And I said, Austin. And she says, surely there's no alcohol in Austin. You know, it's like, everybody thinks that's the solution. If you could just get someplace, you know, we had this thing in Texas called dry counties. Any of y'all have those things? You can't buy booze in the county and you got to drive 80 miles to go get a drink. And we did often, you know, stuck up like going to Sam's, you know, it's like, what the heck? Anyway, in the early 80s, I trying to save a marriage, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't stay sober and she left and I had 7 more years in and out trying to get well. And in those meetings, everybody's trying to help me and that's part of my story and I'm not going to belabor it. The war stories almost killed me. Because every alcoholic out there, you know, you tell a story and I can vaguely identify with part of it, but the other part I can't. So you're immediately discounted as a source of information. You go into the net, you'll follow. And it seems like in AA what we did, and we still do it around the country, is that we want to try to one-upmanship. He's got a DWI. There's going to be somebody else in there, guys. Praise Jesus, that's going to have 2 DWIs. I'm much worse than him. I had 6 DWIs and was in penitentiary, and I chopped up 400 people and put them in plastic bags. And I, you know, and I'm just like I said, I'm not blacking out. I've never had a ticket. I've never lost a job as a result of drinking. Y'all understand? I'm just, you're scaring me to death. But I'm driving away thinking, I'm not like those people. I walk in and I sense that I am. But the minute you start telling the stories, I leave. I know our stories are important. Please don't come up after this is over and explain to me how they're the most important thing. It's not the most important thing. But in a 12-step call, you got to have a story. And from the podium, you better have a good story. Make up something if it's not good. I don't know. What are they going to do? Fact check it? I mean, I don't know. In a 12-step call, like I said, you better have a story. But when you're sitting down and the ladies here, the guys here, and he's come to the meeting, it's time for the stories to go away. Bye-bye, stories. Now let's start talking about the solution. Page 17 talks about it. We'll talk about it in a little bit. And that's the problem why I couldn't stay sober. In 87, after a suicide attempt, I ended up back in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I landed in a room full of people that were all carrying big books. And that confuses you, doesn't it? This is a little big book. And I've been in AA for 7 years and didn't own any big book. We didn't do big books in the meetings I'm going to. We're there to share about our days, and that's how we stay sober. No. Okay, I'm preaching to the choir here. That's okay. And I walked in, and these guys, I got to tell the story. I mean, this little girl snuck up behind me because I was fixing to leave, and she hooked her finger in my belt loop and set me down on the table and said, sit down, cowboy. And she's like, cowboy, what? And it's like, you know, if it had been an old hairy leg boy, I'd have just shoved her out of the way, him out of the way. This girl is like, what? Her sponsor was across the way, couldn't get to me, little narrow, smoky room, and she pointed, and this girl got me, stopped me. She understood her primary purpose. It didn't say if it's the right gender. Y'all understand? She knew another suffering alcoholic, and she knew I was going to leave. The old lady had seen me leave 100 meetings before. Stop him. And she stood between me and the door and said, sit down, with a big grin, and got me a cup of coffee, and I stayed. She saved my life. Emails from all over the world from people that had the same miracle. Sometimes it was a crusty old guy. Sometimes it was, I don't know who God's going to use to help you. But when they went around the chair, around the room, and the chairperson had seen me before up there. And he said, we've got a newcomer coming back. Not a newcomer, been around forever. Why don't we go around and tell how our lives have changed as a result of working the 12 steps? He didn't say, if anybody's got a problem they need to talk about, they might drink. He didn't say that. Thank God. He didn't say, let's tell Chris how he got here. Ooh, let me guess. You drank too much. And see, some of you are laughing and some of you are not because you think that's what it's about. Guys, we got to stop trying to scare newcomers into recovery. We're supposed to be pulling you with a vision of how cool life is in recovery. And that's what these guys did. They went around the room and they talked about getting their credit cards back. And they talked about getting a new car. And they talked about going back to school and having cool relationships and buying houses and doing the things. Guys, I'm less than 24 hours away from a suicide attempt. The last thing I need to hear is how you nearly committed suicide. Okay. All right. What I need to hear is your life better today as a result of coming into this fellowship and staying? Yeah. It blew me away. At the end of the meeting, somebody they asked me if I wanted a chip. I said, absolutely. They gave me one. We sat down, did the Lord's Prayer. And I was fixing to leave. And this guy came up with them old glasses just like I wear. That I swore I would never wear. And he looked over and he had a big book all busted up with old duct tape around it. You know, it was like, you know, one that had been used for something other than a coffee coaster. And he looked up and he said, Chris, I just need to ask you a question because I sure want to help see you not come in and out so much. You know, I know everybody gets their own experience here, but you're going to die if you don't get well. He says, are you done? He didn't say today. He said, are you done? The big book asked me to ask you if you're done. If you're not, that's okay. You're welcome. I'm not here to judge. If you're done, though, there's certain things that we need to do. We just read it and how it works. You're ready to take certain steps. Not a month from now, not 6 months from now, now. I said, yes. And they sat down and they opened a book and they talked about the circle triangle and they explained to me why I couldn't stay sober. In a three-part program designed to treat a three-part illness, they showed me point blank why I couldn't stay sober. And because I'm not in all three parts of the program. All I'm doing is going to meetings. Meeting makers make it. Not knocking meetings at all. I'm just saying if that's all you're doing and you're like me, you won't stay sober. You'll go crazy. And that we're going to talk about that next hour. Anyway. The next day we did a third step prayer and they gave me a notebook and we started working on a fourth step. 2 weeks later, I've got a completed fourth step. I'm ready to do a fifth step. They're teaching me the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. After every meeting, we're talking about prayer and meditation. They're talking about service work. And it dawns on me sitting on the tailgate of my truck that the obsession to drink had lifted and hadn't returned in 26 years. The miracle of recovery. Guys, one of the problems of the Hughes Act, one of the problems is with AA trying to get in bed with the treatment centers, and I'm not knocking that at all. I'm saying our literature got all watered down, and we started giving these mixed messages. Nobody in AA was trying to hurt me. Every time an old guy would come up and say, you want to do some step work, there was somebody to say, you don't need to do that. All you need to do is go to meetings, and everything's going to be okay. Neither one's trying to hurt me. They were both trying to help. But the person whose experience that I needed to listen to was the little big book thumper that understood that no human power can relieve what's wrong with us. I got to have a spiritual experience. It's not an option. Question and answer on sponsorship. Most men and women who have been in AA for more than a few months recognize its program is based on spiritual principles. At the same time, they appreciate that alcoholics have been able to achieve and maintain sobriety without any belief in a personal higher power. Yeah, where'd I get it? Right off the literature rack. I mean, I'm just saying, you see how a newcomer could get really confused here. This guy's saying you got to have a spiritual experience. This guy over here saying, yeah, don't worry about that. Like, okay. Y'all follow? I got some stickers up here. I don't know if I can send you some if I don't have enough for anybody. But there was an excerpt from a book. I'll end with this. There's an excerpt from a book, called As Bill Sees It. There on one of the pages, there was a letter that Bill Wilson wrote in 1942. And the excerpt from this letter says, our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. Okay. That's all we're going to talk about tonight and tomorrow. We're going to talk about what is an adequate presentation of the program. An adequate presentation is, am I going to glean enough information so that I will know how to finish the steps, have a spiritual experience, and transmit that back to the newcomer? That's an adequate presentation of the program. Keep coming back is not an adequate presentation of the program. I'm not trying to be sarcastic. I'm being really sarcastic. I'm sorry. It's like triage with a newcomer, guys. We got to get them. We got to get them in here. We got to get them well. And hopefully the window of opportunity will stay open long enough so that we can get this work done, have this spiritual experience, that we can turn around and get some more help in the trench, helping us help other alcoholics and addicts get sober. Make sense? In AA, we're here for the alcoholics. That's what we're about. This is about triage. This is not therapy. This is not just time away from alcohol. We're going to talk about that next hour. This is what all try to do to be more effective. My chief responsibility is an adequate presentation of the program. We've got a big sign about the size of this right here in our AA club in Ingram, Texas. And that's written on the wall. So everybody understands that that's what we're about. We don't have open discussion meetings in our group. We don't sit around and talk about our day. We talk about the literature so that the newcomer might, if they're interested, understand the miracle of what we're trying to talk about. Because the solution is here. I'm going to let my friend Larry pick this up. I want to say one thing real quick, guys. I get criticized sometimes because I'm knocking the fellowship. I've never said that from the podium. I never will say that from the podium. I have been so blessed by getting to know you people and getting to know the information that I glean from my brothers and sisters in this program is absolutely phenomenal. But the miracle for me was sitting down and clearing out the gunk in a process called the 12 steps that allowed me to wake up and realize that there was a power out there that cared, that seemed to be there for me when things got tough. And that's been my experience. I'm not painting the picture that everything is rosy in recovery 24/7. All of y'all know that's not true. But the problem is that we don't seem to understand that I can stay spiritually fit and I can stay sober when things are good and when things are absolute crap. What kind of a cruddy, stupid program do we have that only works when everything's happy going my way? Sometimes things don't go my way. And that's what we're about. I want to be on some rock solid ground. And so some of you cats, y'all are absolutely free in us to discuss any of what we're talking about. Hopefully we'll pick some curiosity. We'll stimulate some of you guys to want to maybe look in the book a little closer and kind of take a new look at these things called the 12 steps. And that's certainly my goal this weekend. Thank you so much.
You know, Chris, as long as you've been doing this, you'd think you'd learn by now that there's another guy going to be up behind you. You keep looking around and calling me a nut job. Seriously? My name's Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm free tonight. Thanks to Dan and the 164 group for having us. It's great to look out here and see my buddy Jim, and I think Melissa may be in the room. And good to see my buddy Jim and Maria. You know, our paths just keep crossing. If you stick around this deal long enough, our universe gets tiny. I was just in West Virginia with a woman from Gävle, Sweden, that contacted a friend of mine, contacted me. I put her in touch with a guy in West Virginia to save a girl in Ohio. And the four of us were together in West Virginia at the same time. That'll bring you to your knees. You know, we talk about the power of God, and God can keep Saturn on its axis, but he can't deal with this little drinking thing. I'm bleeding up here. It's okay. I snagged myself. If I start going down, it's because I'm losing blood pressure. You know, it's funny. I walked up. Where's Marty from Canada? There he is. I'm in the parking lot. Chris and I get out of the car, and Marty walks up. And he says, "Oh, my God, Gandhi." I was in Halifax, Nova Scotia last year, and this big, elegant hotel, and I'm doing the Saturday night pitch, and I came down off this winding staircase, and I went over to the little store to get a bottle of water to take to the podium. And there's this woman from the Middle East there, and she says, "Could you wait a moment?" And I said, "Yeah." So she goes in the back and gets her husband and her little kids, and they come out, and he comes out, and he's beaming. He says, "You are him." I said, "Yes." He says, "You are him." And I said, "Who?" I'm thinking I'm the speaker, right? He says, "You're Gandhi." So I went to the podium in front of all these people and said, "Good evening, my name's Ben Kingsley, and I'm an alcoholic." You know, Chris called me last night. He was trying to get out of Texas, and we've had some horrible, horrible weather in Atlanta. And I'm just going to touch on this because I'll spend the next hour crying. I lost my very best friend and travel partner a year ago yesterday, Charlie Yao. And I promised that on that day, to commemorate his passing, that I would go for a motorcycle ride because we've ridden thousands of miles together. Well, my day went long. So when I decided to get kickstands up, it was 18 degrees. Yeah, I didn't go for a long ride. You know, and then I get down here. It was like 21 when I left this morning. And tomorrow evening or sometime, I get on a plane and go to New Jersey to wrap up the weekend. And I think it's going to be 12 when I land there. But this is some glamorous stuff we get to do. You know, our paths are different. And how I got here was a little different than Chris's. Not a treatment center guy. I was ready to be plucked. But the downside is, much like Chris, I almost died in the rooms. Nobody ever told me about this book. Don't know that I asked. And if I saw anybody carrying one, I avoided them because they were way too damn serious. And then about five years into this thing, a couple of brothers in Atlanta snagged me. And they asked me if anybody had ever taken me through this book the way that Joe and Charlie presented it. And I said, no. And those men gave me and my family 6 months of their life. And man, I had a whole new universe blow open. And exposure to the truth. I don't know that I would have stayed a sixth year. Hanging out on the porch playing grab ass with the girls and smoking cigarettes. That just wouldn't keep me sober. But that was my existence in AA. Went to a lot of meetings because that's where the pretty girls were. You get any stitches? I take these blood thinners, and I swear to God, I was talking to my doctor yesterday. I mean, if you get a nick. Anyway, give you an example. There's a young man that I've been watching do this for years and years and years and years and years. He was one of my grand sponsees at one time and married little kid, and we stayed friends. I would see him. He's a major executive for one of the cell phone companies, and I would run into him on a regular basis. About 4 weeks ago, he called me on a Sunday, and he says, I'm dying, I need your help. He had overshot the mark and was dying in the bedroom of his mother's house. And thank God, his little girl, his little three-year-old girl, came and found him and brought mom in there. And she got him back because she had some medical experience. And I said, why did you call me, Trevor? He said, because you never turn your back on me. He says, and I don't know where else to go. I've been through 13 treatment centers and AA doesn't work. Maybe you've got, because you keep showing up smiley and happy. And I want to know what it is that you're doing that hasn't been introduced to me. Qualified him on Monday. Talking about doing the steps quickly. Not one of the first 100 took over 30 days to take the steps. And the only reason some of them took 30 days is because they were detoxing hard. But we started him on Monday, and on Thursday he was making night step amends. For years I would see Trevor, and he just looked like he wanted to die. He's wearing long sleeve shirts in the dead heat of the summertime, and we know what that's all about. Today, when you see this man 4 weeks down the road, there's a gleam in his eye. He's happy. He's got a zest for life. So I see this thing working. And for a number of years after I got introduced to the material, to the truth that's in this book, I, like many of you, like some of the things Chris talked about, I felt like I was a closet recovered guy because you took so many shots, if you use that word. You know what we have is a daily reprieve, Larry. Yeah. And then I met this guy. And somewhere along his little twisted delivery, he gave me permission to come out of the closet. And I don't care what you think of me today. I'm not going to quit working with others. I'm going to do what our founders did because, you see, it worked for them. I grew up north of here in Jacksonville, Florida. In the summertime, my parents would send me to Hazelhurst, Georgia to work in the tobacco fields. And I was so small, they wouldn't let me actually get down and crop the tobacco. So my job was to drive the tractors. And so early on, I got a lifelong love affair with the internal combustion engine. And it wasn't just so much of the motors, but they burned gasoline. And I got to gas them things up and found out what the effects of alcohol or gasoline would do to the human body. And during the lunchtime hour, when the farmhands were in the house eating lunch, I'd be out at that 1,000-gallon pump pumping gas in these tractors, and they'd find me passed out under that pecan tree with a grin on my face. I love gas. Well, it wasn't long. I came home, and I went to work down the street, two blocks down the street in the Amoco station pumping gas. You know, stick your head down there next to that gas tank, and you hear that gas coming up in the fill neck, and you just pass out grinning. And it went from gas to glue to scouring the alleys, trying to find discarded bottles by the winos and that. And I've never been a discriminating kind of guy. I just don't care what it tastes like. You hear people say, oh, I love a good single malt scotch. Hell, I'm crazy about a good box of wine, you know. I hear people say that, well, I was alcoholic from birth. Well, I can't say that, but I took my first drink at 6. And it burned and tastes like hell, and I swore I'd never do that again. And little did I know, I'd chase that demon for the rest of my life. And doing an abbreviated thing here. I got involved in the entertainment business through rock and roll radio in Jacksonville. And during those days, there were a lot of big rock and roll bands out there. And a lot of this will come out tomorrow when we get into that four-step discipline. I got out of radio and went to work for the management team with Lynyrd Skynyrd and 38 and them cats. And it was the job that I dreamed about. And October the 20th of 1977, we were in Greenville, South Carolina, getting ready to head to Baton Rouge for, I think it was the second or third night of that Street Survivor's leg. And the band, that life had just gotten a little nuts, and I was making the transition from being on the road with these lunatics to actually going to work doing support for MCA Records. And during that transition interview with one of the execs from that record company, an argument ensued, and, you know, I did as I always did, go screw yourself, and I ain't getting on the plane. We were all horrified of that plane because it was dying. It was dying a slow death, and there were a lot of people that didn't get on that plane. But a buddy of mine came and got me and took me back to Jacksonville, and later that evening we found out that the Freebird had fallen into the swamps of Macomb, Mississippi. I'm not a good flyer, not because of that close miss, because, you see, I like to get loaded and lie. I was in a little old bar, a buddy of mine on down in Jacksonville, called Fling Nasty Saloon. It was about a quarter the size of this room, and when you walked, your feet would stick to the floor. And it had that little old pool table over in one end. And there'd been so much beer spilled on that pool table, when you'd go to break, that cue ball would roll about that far and just lock up. Fling Nasties was a biker bar. But see, in the 70s, the bikers knew where to go get that good stuff from the hippies that hung out at the biker bar. So there was a lot of turmoil, a lot of violence in there, because the hippies had what the bikers wanted, and bikers would go to any length to get it. You know what I mean? Well, I'm in there one night just fried, man, and this cat walked up to me, and he goes, "Hey, I've never seen this guy before, nor since." He says, "Do you like to fly?" Cold November night. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I love to fly." Give you a light, little idea how Larry thinks. He said, "Well, I got a little plane out here at this airstrip. Let's go for a ride." And I said, "All right." Well, we get in the car, and we're headed to Hurlong Field. And about 10 minutes into the drive, I had that moment of clarity. I thought, "Larry, you don't even know this boy's name. You've never seen him. He may not even have a damn driver's license." And I'm not going to say, "Could I see your pilot's license?" Because I'm a cowboy, see? We get almost to the airstrip, and that little voice, that moment of clarity, that little voice came in and said, "You know, this ain't a good idea. Now would be the time to just say no." And the cowboy said, "Oh, hell no, we're going." So we pull up on this little grass runway, and this guy gets out and runs over to this little trailer house. He said, "I'll be right back." And he goes in this little trailer house. There ain't no tower. There ain't nobody out there. It's a grass runway. You got it? It's like a crop duster deal, you know. And light comes on. He comes out. He waves. He jumps in the airplane. The lights come on, and nothing else happened. He got out, went back in the trailer house, came back, got another plane. Light came on. Nothing else happened. I'm a pretty quick study. We're stealing a damn airplane. The voice of reason says, "You need to pull the plug on this." The cowboy said, "No, this is going to be fun." So the third attempt, this boy jumps in a plane, and it belched a little bit of smoke, and I got in the plane, and off we went. I got that headset on, and he says, "Where you want to go?" And I said, "Dude, you're driving." He said, "Well, let's go buzz the bar." Well, the bar is like one of these busy streets out here. This is not rural. It's in a very, urban setting. And so somehow or another, he got the bar on them headsets and told them we were coming. But like the way the crow flies, it's about 10 minutes. And all of a sudden, that thing started dropping down, and he banked it over on that left side. And I'm looking out his window, and there's all the hippies and bikers in the parking lot doing this. And I love doing crazy stuff, but I like doing it drunk. And I had sobered up by this time. And so he buzzed over the top of that bar, and that went all right. And then all of a sudden, we went about 5 minutes further east. And there's a river there called the Temecuana River, and there's the Ortega Bridge goes over it. Somebody here from Jacksonville nodding. You know what I'm talking about. Well, you know that bridge doesn't have a square opening. It's one of them little half-moon things. And I live in Atlanta now. We don't have tides in Atlanta. Jacksonville is a coastal town, and it's governed by tidal waters. I didn't check the damn tides before I left the house. But we dropped down over the top of this river, and we're flying down through there, and I got to looking, and we're coming up on that bridge. And I looked at these wings, and I thought, I'm a pretty quick study. If we're going to go through there, we're going to need a little Vaseline on this deal. I spoke in California not long ago, and somebody said, "Did y'all crash?" I don't fly well. I don't fly well. And we do this a lot. But anyway, in 1980, I'd hit a bottom. I was completely homeless. The music business had not been good to me. Better to say, I hadn't been good with the music business, and I was homeless. I had lost everything, and I used to say I moved to Atlanta. No. I escaped to Atlanta, and I was living on my brother's couch. And I ended up going to work for another record company that we had done some stuff with back in the day. And by 1980, I'm completely unemployable. Nobody wants me because all I know how to do is get up and get loaded. And then I got to do something else to get that edge off so I can pass out so I can come to and do it again. I'm caught up in that terrible cycle. And truth be known, by 1980, I was primed for the picking. But see, I wasn't hanging around with y'all. I was still hanging out in the bars and over in the trap, doing the things I needed to do. Girl that I had lived with off and on for 10 years, she'd gone to work for the record company, and in September of 1987, she came home from work one day. I was about that big around. Like Bill Wilson talked about, he was 40 pounds underweight, could eat little or nothing when drinking, which was all the time. She came home and she said, "Larry, you got to go. You can't live here because you're dying. And I'm homeless again." Through a turn of events, my older brother had found you, and he got a hold of me out there in the street because I was getting day beds. Nobody's letting me stay. They say, "You come here and spend the night, but in the morning we go to work, you got to be gone." So my brother 12-stepped me and put my hand in yours, and you in turn put my hand in the hand of God. And wow, grace, man. It's all grace. But when I got here, I'm not going to tell you that I was hopeless, because you see, there's a lot of difference between hopeless and desperate. My old buddy Charlie used to say that desperate's got a little wiggle room. You know, you still got a card you can play. You still got that lawyer in your pocket. And if you say just the right thing, that might, your buddy might let you back on that job site. But hopeless means you're going to die. And see, in 1987, I still had some good ideas. If I could just get that job back and get back in that big house. So I bounced around in and out. I'd come to your stupid meetings every night, and I'd go get drunk every night after the meeting was over. It's December 31st, 1987, and I had one of them day beds. I started drinking early in the morning. What I'm about to share with you is pretty much hearsay. Sometime late in that night, that woman that owned that house with her two little kids was in the kitchen cooking collard greens and black-eyed peas, and I went in into a blackout, and I dumped that 4-gallon pot of rolling boiling water on her arms while she was cleaning collards in the sink. Stand-up guy. January 1st, 1988, y'all came and got me. I knew hopelessness at that stage. I knew what that meant completely, because there was no door number two. I'm a homeless guy. I didn't know about state-funded detox. And when I started detoxing, it's just only by the grace of God I made it, because I mean, it was a bad one. So I start going to meetings with my brother. And I did whatever y'all told me to do. Come early, stay late, put out the ashtrays, make coffee, whatever you got to do, because I was scared to death I wasn't going to make it. I was right there on that ragged edge. I hated the old timers. God almighty, I hated them. Sons of bitches. Then I met a cat in 1992. After 5 years of hanging out on the porch playing grab ass, and he introduced me to the men. He introduced me to men's retreats and men's workshops and men's meetings. He introduced me to the men, and the men are what saved my life. When I quit playing grab ass and I started looking for a real solution, the men are the ones that saved me. Never trusted men. How you doing? And it's just been a great ride. Having the men wrap their arms around and love on me and teach me how to trust another human being without any expectations. For 10 years, I did nothing but men's meetings. Because see, if I go into a co-ed meeting, I start looking better and sounding better. I grow about 2 or 3 inches. I get this big, fluffy head of black hair. And for a little over 10 years, me and a partner of mine, we did a book study, a Joe and Charlie style book study at a men's facility in Atlanta. And one night at a at a holiday party, this girl came up to me and she said, "My boyfriend has been coming to your book study, and would you consider bringing this to the women?" And I said, "Oh, no. No way. Well, we don't have anything like that available." And I called some men that I trusted, and they said, "You know, you got this gift, you got to give it away." So a little over 10 years, 10 years ago, we founded a group, which is my home group. It's called We Are Not a Glum Lot. It was founded by women. It's grounded by women. Chris has been there a couple of times. And if you're going to come to that meeting on Thursday night, get there early if you want a decent seat, because see, there's about 250 show up, and the women come and put their shawls and their purses and all that stuff on about the first 6 rows. And these little old yahoos from the little jitter joints come in there and try and hit on them girls, and they have got their nose in the book. And boys, you might get your ass whipped and they're hitting on one of them. I mean, I'm blessed. I got thrown into a group of big book thumpers, and that's what we do. We start at the blank page. As a matter of fact, when I get back, a cat that went through his treatment center is now my book study partner. God, it had to be 15 years ago, maybe. Gene Russell. And when I go back, we get to start at the blank page, and I can't wait. But we have a ball in there. This deal is so much fun. If this wasn't fun, I wouldn't be sober today. I just celebrated an anniversary, and when I was reflecting on the time that I've been with you, the greatest gift I've got is excitement and passion. We're talking about it in the lobby coming over. When I get complacent and I start drifting away from you, I drift away from God. And I get some good ideas. And Larry's ideas will kill me deader than fried chicken. The thing I love about the dance we get to do is finding those hopeless little Larrys out there and watching those lights come on. Because, see, when y'all attend these gigs like this, y'all are seeing the back of each other's heads. Chris and I got the best seat in the house. Because this weekend, we're going to see a flicker. We're going to see it go off. And there ain't no price for that admission, man. That's it right there. Y'all know what today is in history? Bill Wilson died in 1971 on this date. Boy, would he be flipping out right now if he could see what's going on in this world. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff going on within our little fellowship, but there's a lot of great stuff going on. 164 is a proven fact of that. And we get to see these little pockets all over the place when we get to go. That brother that snagged me back in 1987... we buried him in 01. And I can tell you that I came from a fragmented family, and you guys have become the family that I never knew. And through bankruptcy, divorce, when that brother's partner called me and said, "Your brother's had a stroke and it doesn't look good," when I got 60 miles away to his bedside, you were there. You were there waiting on me. You've always been there. When that day came that we had to say goodbye to him, you were there. And it's, you know, I think the book even uses the word, it's inexplicable. The things that we get to share in here and the little nuggets that we get to snag and share with another guy. We're going to unfold some of these miracles a little bit further tomorrow. I'm just excited to be with you. It's going to be a fun time. The last time I was with this guy, we were in Iceland. looking out at the most beautiful women on the planet and a bunch of damn Vikings. Every one of them guys look like they need to be chewing on a cow leg over there. But we ought to have some fun this weekend. We good on time? Thanks, guys. Don't touch me.